Hope everybody had a very nice vacation on the Sukkot. You can find the instructive event, deep metaphysical philosophical questions. What you're supposed to do is sitting in the Sukkot. Since you're held by Ananei HaKavod, what else would a person think about other than his causes, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, etc., etc.? For those of you who didn't, instead of that, we're chazering Gittin. Imagine what else we're going to do in the Sukkot. They're too small. Usually they're too small for ping-pong tables. So. What else could you do in a Sukkah? I don't actually remember what we spoke about the last time, but the last important topic we spoke about when we were running through different versions of proofs of the specifically the cosmological proof of God, when I talked about the ethical proof of God, which is a version of the cosmological proof, is Immanuel Kant's Maskana. Proofs of God, and which is based on the fact that if an ethics exists, by ethic I mean an obligatory ethic, something which obligates you to act in a certain manner because it is true, because it's good and these things are bad, then you've proven, in the language of the proof, proven there is a God, but what it means, because Elijah, you've proven there is something which meets the definition which we set forward in the beginning of the cosmological proof, something which affects the world, which is a cause of things in the world, but is not caused by anything in the world. Something which is outside the picture of cause and effect, outside the natural. In other words, a supernatural quality. And that we call God. What we really should be doing now is developing, not so much the proof, but the idea which lies behind it, namely the status of ethics in our thinking, in Judaism, etc. And that's what we're supposed to be doing, but I can't resist before that, doing a knetch. So we'll probably only begin next week talking about what is the status of ethics, divine ethics, the relationship between our ethics, divine ethics, and Judaism, the question of the Akedah, the question of Avinu, etc., etc., etc. And today we're going to do a little bit of another variation on the cosmological proof. The reason is because it's the best one. It's the one that you cannot comfortably answer. All cosmological proofs can be answered, but some cannot be answered comfortably. And that's what we're going to do today, which we could call, for lack of another name, the rational proof. Not that it's a rational proof, all proofs are rational. The proof of rationality. Not the proof of ethics, the proof of rationality. If you recall, the answer to the ethical proof, to the proof from the existence of ethics, was that ethics doesn't exist. That was the answer. If you wish to be a naturalist, if you wish to say that nothing exists other than the system of mechanical cause and effect, then you simply have to say that the proof is based on a non-existent quality. There is no such thing as ethics in the way I describe it. And then you have to think of another theory, a theory to describe what people call ethics. So it could be a psychological view of ethics. It could be, I think, which I said in the name of Stevenson, that ethics doesn't exist at all. It's just a matter of preference. When I say something is good, I mean I like it. You have a better form of ethics. They say that ethics is what social mores, is what society developed for itself to make things work better. But all of those come in and say that nothing is actually obligatory. There's no such thing as obligation. There only is what is. There only are things. And ethics is merely what we've decided, the rules that we have decided which would work well. Just to give an example of the implication of that, you really say there's no difference between something which, for those of you who I mentioned other places as well, but anyone who grew up in Manhattan, surely knows about, there would be no difference between the issue of double parking and the issue of stealing or of murder. I mean, no difference. There's difference, perhaps in a relative difference, but there's no real difference. They're both rules which society organized to make things work better. If you double park, you hurt the economy, and if you kill people, you sometimes hurt the economy. I mention this because those people who grew up in New York City know that it's only us at double park when you think you might get caught. But it's really us at the steal. And the reason is because it's ethically wrong to steal. But double parking is merely socially inconvenient. And therefore, you might think that it's mutter to make an exception when it's very important to you. I say that not as a psak halacha. I know for a fact that Lichtenstein never double parked when he lived in Manhattan. Which is truly amazing if you know the parking situation in Washington Heights. But most of us will hold it on this psalm, at least at least all the local police had an agreement with us not to give out tickets between 8 and 11 in the morning and overnight. That's why there was a whole field today of people thinking of alternatives to supernatural ethics. In fact, the term supernatural ethics is used in a derogatory sense in modern philosophy. It's people who can't have a good theory of ethics, so they simply say that they can't explain it, so it just comes from outside. And I said there are all kinds of different versions, and it goes, there's evolutionary versions, and psychological versions, and social versions, and Stam versions, but all of them come to deny the fact that ethics really exists. Most people, in their hearts, think ethics does exist, until they learn philosophy and then try to work their way out of it, which is why it is a good proof. You force people to either believe in God, or believe in some sort of a God, believe in the divine basis of ethics, or to claim there's no ethics, you've accomplished something. You've made a pretty wide goal. You explain what I explained in the beginning of these shiurim, that the main purpose today of the fruits of God is to draw the line and say, you know, either or. In order to be a thoroughgoing atheist, you have to make decisions about a whole host of other questions, which people are loath to make. But if you're willing to say that ethics doesn't exist, you can get away with it. Today's proof, its advantage is, it's extremely difficult to say that the phenomenon doesn't exist. There are philosophers who say that, but it's almost always funny. In other words, it's impossible to say that not smile. And that's why, simply from the point of view of practicality, it's a very good proof of the existence of God. And the other thing is that it does help us, the other questions we talk about, to illuminate some major questions in modern thought, in modern arguments. Just read any intellectual magazine for more than 2 or 3 months, you'll come across questions relating to this, because it's the cutting edge of specifically neurobiology and various other things that are being done by brain scientists. If anyone gets the impression, I noticed that the last time I spoke, I made a disparaging remark about sociologists, and potentially someone could have gotten insulted by that. So today I'm going to make disparaging remarks about brain scientists. You shouldn't have anything against brain scientists. Very close to my family is a brain scientist, but they're very dangerous people. The rational proof of the existence of God goes like this. I'll give a little hakdama. The hakdama is due to stolen from an article by C.S. Lewis, who said it much better than I could, so I'm going to use his example. It's written almost 80 years ago, but it's still good. Lewis talks about minor sensibilities, he could have been writing them today. The first thing, Lewis tells the story of two people. Two people are walking down the street, and there's a dog barking, and they both immediately panic and feel their throats constricting and sweat on their brow, and they quickly run for shelter. Now, why did they do that? So there are two different reasons for these two people. The first one, when looks at the dog, notices the size of the dog's incisors, sees the gleam in his eye, perhaps sees the froth at his mouth, remembers the quickly whips out his smartphone, checks on Google, sees that those are well-known simanim for an imminent attack of a rabid dog, and therefore flees for his life. Okay, that's one reason. The second guy has a different action altogether. You see, it turns out that when he was very, very young, when he was 3 years old, he was once bitten by a dog. And since then, whenever he sees anything vaguely resembling a dog shape, of any size, or even hears something that sounds like a bark, he immediately has tremors. And it's an uncontrollable impulse. He's undergone many, many years of therapy. They tried exposing him to dogs and not exposing him to dogs. All the dog lovers in the world have tried to fix him, and they can't do anything about it. Okay? So these are two different reasons why somebody panics at the sight of a dog. We, in our common English language, say the first reason is a rational reason, and the second reason is an irrational reason. What do we mean by that? What does the term mean? Why they both work. The sibatiyut, the causation, is true in both cases. What do we mean by saying the first is a rational reason, the second is an irrational reason? Rational reasons are causes or reasons which meet a certain standard of rationality. It's a circular definition. There is a logical connection between A and B. Irrational reasons are reasons which are which work. I mean, they do cause they cause action, but they're merely haphazard. There's a certain haphazard connection in this person's brain, a conditioned reflex, a psychological development in this person's brain, which causes him to react the way he does. And for that, hey, I really don't mean to be disparaging. That's called an irrational. Doesn't mean it's bad. Might not be bad. It's simply a fact. But there's no rational reason to run away from a small dog who has no teeth. And if you do run away, it's because whatever, you've been conditioned by one of Pavlov's dogs in reverse when you were a little child, and that's why you do it. This distinction is essential to the way we think. Right? In other words, we try to cure the second guy, we wouldn't try to cure the first guy. We wouldn't say to him, no, it's just, you're just doing that because of, you read it on Google. You're just doing it because it has a rational reason. But if you just get over the rationality, you wouldn't run away from dogs. No, he's right to run away. The second guy, we think, is not necessarily right to run away. He's losing out on life. He could have a lot more fun in life. And therefore, we'll try to give him the proper medicine, etc. Okay, this it affects everything we do. In other words, if I ask, why is there light in the room? And you tell me, you give me one of two answers. You say, the light is on the room because somebody turned it on. That's a very important answer. It explains a lot. Or you say, there's light in the room because, well, when electrons run through metal at a certain amount of voltage, they cause the metal to heat up and give out light. These are two different kinds of explanations for the same phenomenon, depending on what we're trying to understand. I want to know why the lights are on now, not on yesterday. Somebody turn them on. I want to know why does light come out of a light bulb. The second one is a kind of rational explanation. Tries to explain the connection between the cause and the effect. And the first one simply tells me what configuration of atoms arose to cause another configuration of atoms to appear. A naturalist, a true naturalist, someone who says that nothing exists other than those things which are in the cycle of, system of cause and effect, has no way of explaining rationality at all. Rationality is a classic example of what we've explored three or four times, something which is a cause of things in the world, but is not caused by anything in the world. Since rationality exists, since there are reasons, therefore, things happen the way they happen. Right? Two things are not in the same place at the same time because it goes against the law of reason. The light bulb goes on because, among other things, because of a rational reason. Because, yes, electrons cause heat in metal. But rationality is not changed by anything that takes place in the world. If we all vote that two things can be in the same place at the same time, they still won't be able to be in the same place at the same time. Nothing that takes place in the world, nothing that takes place in the system of natural causes and effects is going to change rationality, but rationality affects everything in the world, even more than ethics. It's very similar to the relationship of ethics to the world. The rules of ethics are rules which are not changed by the world but affect the world. The rules of rationality are rules which are, they affect everything much more effectively. Ethics you can shrug off. But the rules of rationality affect everything in the world but are not affected, ki hu zeh, but it takes place in the world. And to this, we use the same line that appears in every single time in Aquinas when he finishes his proofs, and this is what we call God. It's not what most of us call God, but it's a kind of God. In other words, we've proven that you cannot consistently have a totally naturalistic view of the world. Of course, you can. You can say, I don't think rationality exists. Now, it's extremely difficult to say that. Because the statement rationality doesn't exist is a statement that attempts to say something that's true. You can't talk about truth and falsity if you don't think that rationality exists. To say that this is the truth, you're saying that this is the truth, it's not just an accidental arrangement in my mind, it's what really exists. People who are thoroughgoing naturalists have to say, well, I don't think rationality exists, but that's just me. That's just the way my mind happens to work. Remember what takes place in ethics. Someone says, I don't think ethics really exists, but I don't like murder. And you don't like murder, but if he likes murder, that's his schut, that's his privilege. That's what happens when you take me have a totally relativistic ethic. The same thing can be done in rationality, but obviously the price is enormous. So to say, I don't think things can be the same, two things can be in the same place at the same time. I don't think something can be true and not true at the same time, but that's just me. That's the way my brain is arranged. That's the way the atoms in my brain are arranged. Anyone who's familiar with some of the work that's been done in the last 20, 30 years in neuroscience knows that they're tending towards that kind of a conclusion. Neuroscientists sit around using fMRI machines, which no one is even sure if it has a basis in fact. No one's sure that. And they try to see like what cell in your brain lights up when you think the following thoughts. And therefore, say about 2 years ago, somebody published a paper explaining why people believe in God. The belief in God is based on a certain development in this part of the brain, having to do with imagination, at the same time as another development in another part of your brain, and between the two of them, so you invent a God. Because what they did is they checked a whole bunch of religious people, both, and all of them had these kind of brain cells. People who don't believe in God didn't have those kind of brain cells. The same thing is done for very strong ethical thinking. People who have a very strong sense of ethics, they feel very obligated to act this way and not to act that way, and it's a dominant force in their lives. Well, we discovered that they have a particular arrangement in their brains. And therefore, and all this is true, by the way, they really have those kind of brains. But what is the non-scientific, but the philosophical conclusion that's being attempted to show? Ethics is merely a particular accidental, particular haphazard way your brain is arranged. If I go in with a knife or a drug or something else and I rearrange the cells in your brain, you won't be ethical anymore. You'll have a different ethic. You'll have a Chinese ethic. You'll have a Hoodlum ethic. You'll have a Haredi ethic. It's just a matter of arranging which way your brain, or no ethic. The same thing is true for belief in God or for other particular thoughts. This is a whole super field of socio-neurology where people are just sitting around, putting people into MRI machines. Anyone here ever been in an MRI machine? It's no fun. You're not allowed to move. Half an hour. And they ask you questions, and you are, in effect, writing people's doctorates. Because whatever you think about it, it's going to prove something. One way or another. Incidentally, you can get 100 shekel. In Hadassah Hospital, they have ongoing studies to do all different sorts of things, and they need constant volunteers. You get 100 shekel for lying in this incredibly claustrophobic prison and hearing these weird noises and imagining that outside. Have you ever seen really bad science fi movies? You imagine that outside there are all sorts of crazy things to your brain. You get 100 shekel. I did not get 100 shekel because my daughter refused to give me the 100 shekel. But you're a stranger. They'll give you the 100 shekel. So, again, just the bottom line. There's no problem in claiming I don't believe in ethics. It's very difficult to claim you don't believe in rationality consistently. In other words, I'm walking on a bridge, and I now test my opinion. It would not be a good idea to jump off the bridge. The bridge is not over the Hudson, it's over the highway. Okay, it would not be a good idea. Now, that's my belief. Is that a rational decision on my part, or is it an irrational decision on my part? About the case of the dogs. I walk in the street, I decide I don't want to walk on the street because the dog is there. Is it a rational decision or an irrational decision? Now, if you're a thoroughgoing naturalist, the only reason why you think you shouldn't jump off bridges is because some accidental arrangement in your brain says that. You've been programmed to think that way. It also is true that everybody I know who jumped off the bridge is no longer around. But that's actually an argument against it. If we ask people to vote, then all those who know for sure that it's not going to jump off the bridge don't get to vote, since they're not with us anymore. But it's just the way your brain is arranged. Now, why is your brain arranged that way? That's the way the cells are arranged. Why are the cells arranged that way? Your parents' genes, evolutionary theory. That's not important as how they got arranged that way. But other people have their brains arranged differently, perhaps. And even if all of us have our brains arranged that way, that's because evolution really works. In other words, all human brains are arranged in a manner that says that if four people jump off a bridge and die, you shouldn't do it either. Who says that that's a logical rule? How do you know if something took place four times in the past, it'll take place the fifth time? That's the way we tend to think. What's the effect? This is a very good question. What effect is the logical basis to say that something took place four times, it'll happen again? The sun rose in the east this morning, and yesterday, and the day before, and the day before. Where will the sun rise tomorrow? Everybody in this room thinks it's going to rise in the east. How do you know that? Well, it's one of the rules of our logic. We don't think it's 100% true, but we think it's 99% true. But why do you think that way? There are crazy people who don't think that way. How do you know they're crazy? Maybe they're right and you're wrong. Or the real conclusion is, what is right and what is wrong here? Just like what is right and what is wrong in ethics, what is right and what is wrong in rationality. This is the way most people thought. The evolutionary theory is very, very simple. Those who didn't think that way, those who thought that jumping off bridges is a good idea, they didn't pass their genes on. Unless they waited a long time to do it. This is classic evolution. Classic evolution. The genes which teach you to think what we call irrational, the genes which tell you to ignore precedent, the genes that tell you that you can walk through solid matter, you can be in two places at the same time, those genes do not reproduce. Because people tend to die when they think that way. People who are super cautious, that's all it is, just caution. They don't jump off bridges. They don't take chances. They live. And they pass on the genes. And therefore, there's an inbred gene in human beings that says, think, quotation marks, rational. One can claim this. But there's a really great, there's nothing illogical about what I just said, except that it's a very painful price to pay. It means you cannot claim that anything is true. You can't think the word truth has any meaning. There's nothing, we don't know the truth, we just know what we know. We just think the way we think. Just like you took a computer, and you programmed the computer to think poorly. To think the one and one is three. If I remember correctly, if you teach a computer to think the one and one is three, it freezes very quickly. There are too many contradictions that take place. But let's say, you know, you have a switch that which resets every time. You know, the computer will work in some way. It won't give you good answers to questions, but the computer will work. Well, we're programmed the way we think. Again, it's like, this is another use to say that I mentioned once. It's the penultimate scene in 1984, for those of you who read it, where someone is taught to think that one and one is three. That's the climax of 1984 by George Orwell, is how you can brainwash. Orwell obviously thought that one and one was two. He was trying to show how human beings can be manipulated to think irrationally. But people today use that same argument to show that there's no difference between the two ways. We have been brainwashed by our parents and teachers to think that one and one is two. And there's presumably some place where there's a school where they've been brainwashed or taught to think in a different manner. It's extremely difficult consistently to do this. Because you can't even claim that what I just said now is true. You can't use the word truth. Truth is only the way I think. Conclusion. It's exactly the same proof as the previous proof. It says that there are rules which we all relate to, and those rules are outside the system. And therefore there exists something, not a physical thing, but there exists something which meets the definition of God, which cosmological proof seeks to show. And as I pointed out previously, as opposed to the case of ethics, which is really important for religion, this proof may not be important to you. The question is how, with what cover do you relate to rationality? It might not mean much to people in the room to say that God exists, and what is God? God is rationality. It doesn't seem to be, maybe that might even be the basis for developing religion. I think it is, but it may not seem. But that's not really the point. The point I was trying to make is that, just like the first mover of the Rambam, is not much of a basis for what we call religion. But the point today, especially, even more than the time of the Rambam, is, as I pointed out a number of times, I'll repeat the sentence, the basic form of atheism, intellectual atheism, today is naturalism. That's the cultural movement which stands in the way in belief of God today is not an opposition to Hashgacha Pratis. It's an opposition to anything that exists outside the system. It's the rise, the historical fact that the rise of science and scientific thinking is parallel to the diminution in religious belief is based on this. That scientific thinking gradually assumes the position of convincing everybody that everything that's in science is true and nothing exists outside. And science is based on a system of cause and effect. Therefore, anything which shows that the system of science is not complete doesn't undermine science, but undermines scientificism. It undermines the philosophy that says that science is the only truth. And what this last proof showed is that there is an internal contradiction claiming that science describes truth. Because if science describes truth, then science also undermines the very existence of truth. Science doesn't describe truth. Science describes the way things happen to be. But they don't possess any level of truth beyond the mikriyut, beyond what happens the way it is. I want to point out, historically speaking, in ancient times that wasn't true. In Aristotle thought that science describes philosophic truth. And But since the 16th century, in the rise of modern science, science no longer believes that it describes philosophical truth. It describes merely accidental truth. The law of gravity happens to work, even though it's universal. And if you're a thorough naturalist, then you undermine yourself, which is okay, but a very big price, a very big price. Yes.
It seems like rationality and logic are natural. Like that is like within nature. Like the reason you don't jump off a bridge is because of the human, like of natural, you want to live. The reason the sun rises is because of nature. It's not because of the reason. It's not because you think, oh, the sun's risen in the last few days. It's because there's a natural way of life. It seems like rationality is like within nature.
No. I understand what you're saying, but you're saying the opposite of what you think you're saying. You're saying is that everything in nature is. Is an effect of rationality.
It is rational.
Nature is rational in the sense that it obeys the laws of rationality. Right? And good people are ethical because they obey the laws of ethics. And if you had a picture of God that says that God commands and that's what it is, then the whole world is religious because everything in the world exhibits God's might. But the thing is, the rules of rationality itself are not subject to cause and effect. The system says that if I affect you, you also affect me. Every action has a reaction. If I hit you, so we both be bound. But the relationship of rationality to nature is one-sided. I agree that everything, that's also one of the advantages, as opposed to ethics, which only affects some things in the world, rationality affects everything in the world, all the time. But the relationship, but it's not the same as the world. In other words, rationality is not the world. Rationality is the rules which the world, which nature obeys. That's exactly the relationship that we are exploring, that there exists something which, I use the word obey here, the word obey is a loan. Right? But it's a convenient loan because we associate obeying with religion and law, etc. Nature obeys the laws of nature. It's an interesting historical fact. We're so used to saying it. It's not 100 years old. It's a 2,500 years that people, those people who have Greek educations, everybody in the room, say that there are laws of nature. But the concept of laws of nature is a loan. Laws, the word law comes from society. There was a particular person, we pretty much know who invented the words. The person who Aristotle identifies as the second philosopher, whose name was Anaximenes. Anaximenes said that nature obeys certain laws. And it's a long word, but we use it all the time. Nature obeys the laws of reason. But the laws themselves, you say they're part of nature, what do you mean they're part of nature? They're an asymmetrical part of nature. Nature doesn't change the laws. The laws change nature.
Right? Nature never gets changed by the laws because it's constant. The laws of nature are constant, so it's never changing.
Okay.
It's neither
they can't be changed.
It's neither affecting the system nor... It's non-existent rationality. It's just part. It's like ethics. I can see is like separate from nature.
That's why I'm going back.
I don't see, but that's why I'm going back.
So that's why we go back. We go back to the story I told in the beginning. C.S. Lewis' stories about the dogs. Fear of dogs, based on childhood experiences, is part of the system. According to psychologists, assuming that it works, okay? If I train you correctly, if I show you a piece of meat and ring a bell, then you will salivate next to this ringing of a bell, okay? But that, we use these terms very usefully. That's an irrational explanation, not a bad. Irrational in the sense that it's not based on rationality, that is a rational explanation. A person salivates when he sees a piece of meat because he's really hungry. When you salivate at the sound of a buzzer, that's an irrational reaction. When you salivate at a piece of meat, that's a rational reaction, okay? Or if you just want to take a piece of meat, that's a rational. If you're hungry, you see a piece of meat, you say, I want it, that's a rational reaction. If you hear a buzzer, and you say, and you begin to salivate, that's an irrational reaction. What do you mean by that distinction? The difference is that one is merely a fact in the world. The other one is a law that comes from outside and causes and is responsible for the way things take place in the world. To say what you said, the rationality is merely the way the world is arranged, is a classic naturalist answer. But you can only say that if you then say that, and it just happens to be true. There's no inherent truth in these laws. and it would be arranged differently, or it could be arranged differently, or we could arrange it differently. Once you say that, then there's no inherent reason why we couldn't arrange it differently. Perhaps we can change these laws by... what interests me the most is by changing the way our brains are arranged. We could also change the way the sun is arranged, but it's just the way things are arranged. And if that's true, then there is no distinction between rational explanations and irrational explanations, which affects science. It affects, obviously, non-scientific fields, but it affects science as well. You can't ever claim to be speaking the truth.
My question is, you said that, a proof is that something supernatural or godly, something that affects the world, isn't affected by the world. It seems like rationality does neither. It doesn't affect nature. It doesn't affect the world or affect the world.
So if you have two possibilities, and this one does not exist, and this one does exist because of the rule of nature, and that's what I call a rule of nature, because of the law of rationality, and that's what I call effective. There are two possibilities. But only one takes place, the other one does not take place. If only one takes place, the other one cannot take place, then something is being machriya. I said in English, someone is making the decision. Someone is weighing the decision in one direction. That something, that missing factor, is something which is affecting the world and not affected by the world. The fact that it's not a matter of locality. It's a question of where do I find it exists. I personally don't think if I didn't believe in a God who exists before and after the world, then rationality wouldn't be found any place else other than in the world itself. But it's not a matter of where it's found. The question is, what is its relationship between A and B? The relationship between the sun and the moon is natural. The sun attracts the moon attracts the sun. Gravity affects the both. The sun lights up the moon, and the moon sends the light back to the sun. Right? Those are two objects that are bound within cause and effect. If you crash the moon into the sun, then the sun will feel pain. Rationality and the world do not have the same relationship. Nothing you can do in the world will have an effect on that thing. It's not a thing in the regular sense. All you're saying is that rationality is not a rationality is not a ball which is giving out orders to the world. It's a noun, but it's not a physical thing. It's not even a non-physical thing. It's not a spirit, and it's not a material thing. It's not a spiritual thing. It's a concept. Say it, but it's a set of rules. A set of rules, obviously by definition, that's what rules mean. Rules are not created by the things they rule on, the things they regulate. But the things they regulate are affected by them. The rules of how to play basketball, are they part of the game or they're not part of the game? That's what you're asking. But that's not what I'm talking about. The rules of basketball affect the game. The game does not affect the rules. If we decide to play differently, that won't change the rules. If we decide that we're all going to foul each other, it doesn't make it legal.
You can't change.
Yeah, because these particular rules are not rational rules, they're made by a committee. But the players can't change the rules. I'm taking a smaller subset. The rules are part of the game only in the sense that you see them, some players you see the rules, but the relationship between the rules and the game is not symmetrical. The game doesn't affect the rules. The rules affect the game. Now, in this particular case, the rules were made by a committee. Yes, the relationship between the rules and the committee is symmetrical. The rules affect the committee when they play, and the committee affects the rules when they sit. As it turns out, with rationality, there is no other committee. One thing I want to talk about, when I talk about in ethics, we'll talk about rationality as well, is whether or not God is the committee which makes the rules. I think not, but that we'll talk about in terms of ethics. Does God make the rules of ethics, or are they simply there? But within our world, there is no committee, and no possible configuration of things which could change the rules of ethics if they exist, and there is no committee which can change the rules of rationality if they exist. And therefore, the only option is to say that it doesn't exist. To say it doesn't exist is a price that you have to be really brave and a little bit weird to pay. As I said, you can only say it with a smile, because you cannot say with conviction, I think rationality doesn't exist. What do you mean you think rationality doesn't exist? That's just what you think. But you don't really believe rationality doesn't exist, because you don't believe in anything. So you have to say this, well, yeah, if I believed in anything, I would believe that you cannot believe in anything. Right? A true atheist believes in nothing. But it's very difficult to believe in nothing, because then you can't even believe that you're an atheist. Like I said, it's not impossible. It's not impossible. There are brave souls who do it, not the famous ones. For those of you who have read the famous atheistic books of the last 10 years, as well as New Atheism. New Atheism is Be'erech caveman atheism. It's nothing to do with that. But New Atheism are people who don't want to be called unethical. They sure don't want to be called illogical. They they don't want to be called rationalists. On the contrary, they want to be the super rational. They want to be that religious people are irrationalists. And you read the first three chapters of Dawkins, you see, by the way, that he's tripping over himself. He's he has a big, deep-seated belief, Dafka, in evolutionary biology, which is a very useful way to show why certain deep-seated, irrational beliefs are simply based on the brain. But once you go on the track of evolutionary biology and say that our brains are arranged the way they're arranged because of social pressure and natural selection, then the last book that you wrote, is also merely a result of social pressure and natural selection. You have a certain way of thinking that's because, well, anyone who grew up in Oxford after a couple of 10 or 15 generations begins to think in a certain way because the other people were thrown out. And that's natural selection in the intellectual world. And they trip themselves up right away in that sense. To be a true atheist, you have to say, I'm about to write a very, very short book. My philosophy book is very short. Nothing is really true or false. Now I have practical books. Practically speaking, I want to write a book in engineering. In my opinion, it's ma'od kedai. It's very, very beneficial to not jump off bridges. I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know whether it's true or not true. I just know that people who follow my rules come home in the evening, and those who don't, don't. And that's my recommendation to you. But I'm not writing anything that's philosophically true. That you can do. Nobody wants to do that. It's just not, you don't get any cap, you don't get any cover for saying that nothing is true. You have to say that something is true, namely that I'm true and they're false. To say that those who believe in absolutist entities are speaking falsehood is to contradict yourself. Okay? That's the rational proof. This is of God, as I pointed out. It's the penultimate proof. It's the last new proof. Well, that's not true. It's the last philosophically new proof to be offered. I don't know who developed it first. Lewis always testified that nothing in his books is new. I suspect he's being overly modest, but I don't know who said this to him. He might have been the first one. It's his belief. There are more modern proofs, even more modern proofs of the God. I recommend very highly a book by Peter Berger called Whisper of Angels that has 19 proofs of the existence of God in one of the first chapters. I don't know if it's 19, maybe it's 13. None of which anyone's ever heard of before. It really, I mean, there's a proof of laughter, proof of amazing amount of things. None of them are really proofs, but they're cool. But they're also basically the same thing. They're also proofs of cosmological proofs. Okay. Yeah?
So, we said that rationality is consistent with making a decision based on logical standards, right? More or less?
Mm-hmm.
So, our standard is self-preservation, but isn't it possible to have different standards? Like a nihilist can make a completely different rational decision than we would and still consider themselves.
Of course.
So it's a God of rationality.
I want to point out how what you're saying now exactly parallels in a slightly different form what we said 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, whatever it was. We have rules of conduct that say that you shouldn't kill people just because they're helpless. Okay? And then you come up, and someone comes up and says, yeah, maybe that's just because that's the way, you know, you have a particular, that's the way you think, because it was convenient, and then you had enough food and anyway to go around. But if you lived in Lucian Islands, that's the example that's given where, because the Lucian Islanders take the old people, they used to, maybe still do. They put the old people in canoes and ship and shove them out into the frozen sea. So you never know. You think differently. That was the relativistic, to prove relativism in ethics. In other words, there is no true ethic. There's merely rules that certain societies have made for themselves because, whatever, it works for one reason or another. It gives you a good feeling. You're saying the same thing about other kinds of rules. You're right. Rationality is just a generalization. It's a generalization of the proof from ethics. And that's the only advantage it has. Because ethics is sufficiently narrow that it's easy to get around it, whereas rationality is difficult to get around. The fact is, it's not my interest to convince anyone in the room on the basis of this proof that you should believe in God. Try to explain how the proofs work, right? But if I was interested in that, so then I would ask, how many people here disagree with the rules of ethics? And nobody would dare say yes, since we're extremely, setting to say that you're not an ethical person. But then someone would say, okay, I really agree with you, but I know that there were studies which show that pygmies in Africa don't agree. when you try to convince somebody the universalism of certain beliefs has a certain weight. Right? If all human beings think the same way, that should give us cause, you know, to pause. And so ethics, that's why I did spend at least 5 minutes 4 weeks ago saying that I truly believe that basic principles of ethics are in fact universal. But universal doesn't mean 100%. There always are totally immoral, not just immoral, amoral people who don't begin to understand what you're talking about. But we consider them to be criminally insane. And the other cases of the Pygmies and the Aleutian Islanders, I think, doesn't really prove anything at all because they have the same basic ethic. They just apply somewhat differently. Now, rationality is really universal. People who don't accept the basic principles of rationality are considered to be totally nuts. I mean, we don't allow them out on the street. But what modern people show sometimes is that universality doesn't prove anything. For instance, again, it's the usual theory today, but it's not the only one, but evolution helps you get around universality. All human brains are arranged to think in a certain way, because the other ones didn't survive. But it just happens to be that that's the way your brain's arranged, to think that something cannot be true and not true at the same time. That if something is either true or not true, there's no law of the excluded middle. Or something cannot be in two places at the same time. But it just happens to be the way you think. And the fact that everybody thinks that way, okay, I have a way of explaining that. I have a way to explain it because I use a different law. There's a law of human nature which makes people think this way. Again, you know, it's the paradoxical cycling stira, self-contradiction involved in using laws of evolution to explain why people all think in the same way. Why is evolution true? Because that's the way people think. You're getting stuck. So again, in other words, sure you can say that. You can say that some people would think differently. The fact that no one, and I would ask you first of all, no one thinks differently. You said, yeah, but they could think differently. I said, okay, so they could think differently. I know personally people who claim they think differently. They just don't claim it very well, but yeah, they claim it differently. All I'm saying is what I've said since we began on this proof, and this is the last time we can talk about proofs of God, all I'm saying is none of the proofs proves anything. It just demands of you to make a serious choice. Do you want to be an amoral person or a moral person? Do you want to be a rational person or a non-rational person, a super-rational person, or a supra-national person? You want to be a person who doesn't care about rationality? Say it, you have free choice. That's also debatable. But I grant you free choice. If you want to be someone who says that morality doesn't exist, you don't plan to steal or be immoral. Just claim that it's what I do, but I don't think that it involves any sort of absolute obligation. Gegenseite, if you want to claim that rationality doesn't exist, Gegenseite is the wrong expression to use. You should not just take off on your own because eventually you'll be on a bridge. But with great caution, you know, somebody should watch over you. You can live out your 70 years in this world and you'll have a happy life. I would suggest you don't write a serious book on philosophy because it's not going to be an interesting book. Anybody here wants to be non-rational? Please. For one thing, you should leave now because there's no reason why you should want to remain in the room since I tend to be rational. But you can have a happy life. No problem involved at all. Again, just for those who are curious, and eventually you're going to be exposed to it, the place in today where the question arises is in neuroscience. Because there, we believe, you know, once we talk about theoretical, this is the way people think. We know what we meant. Today, there are theories and evidence to explain why people think the way they think. And you can base it on a particular arrangement, not of atoms, but of cells. The way the neurons in your brain are arranged, the way the ganglia relate to one another, that is the way you think. Okay, talk about a computer, which is the muscle, but I talk about the real thing. And they do experiments to show that how we change it a little bit and people think differently. They really think differently. Even a drug, you can get people to think differently. Because you affect the way certain cells affect other cells. So what's the upshot? What we call thinking or rationality is the haphazard arrangement. Haphazard is the wrong word, because evolution is arranged that way. It's the accidental arrangement, what happens to be the arrangement of neurons in our head. It's a wonderful theory. But you're then saying is that if that's true about belief in God or belief in ethics, it's also true about belief in anything. You know, that's the way our brains think, the way they think, because of that's the way that we do it. And therefore, then we go in our imperialistic manner and we convince computers, we program computers to think like us. Should be the other way around. You get the computers to reprogram us to think like them. Or we should get mice to program us to think like them. Because who said that we're thinking, you know, cows don't think very well, and that's why they're happier. By the way, this is a real problem in psychiatry. What happens if somebody comes to you? You're a psychiatrist, and he explains to you why he's unhappy. The truth is, he's unhappy because he should be unhappy. He's unhappy. You see, he's very, very unhappy. And you realize the reason why he's unhappy is because he's leading a terrible life. And he's unethical, and illogical, and immoral. And as we all know, immorality causes unhappiness. It's foolish in Aristotle. So what can you do for him? You know, if you're a rabbi, you convince him to live a better life, and then he'll be happy. He explains to you that's much too difficult. It's just too late for that. He's invested so much money in building up his mafia network that he just can't get away from it now. He's addicted to it. So if your psychiatrist will say, well, I can make you happy, you know, we'll just detach that part of your brain which connects leading a sordid, miserable, misanthropic life with unhappiness, well, we'll change the brains a little bit, we'll give you a pill, and you can continue living a life and you'll still be happy. And that's what psychiatry does, because unhappiness is merely a particular arrangement in your brain, the right drug, a little bit of Valium here, a little bit of Prozac there, and you can be a better mafioso. Is anyone in the room who didn't see The Sopranos? Like, what are the ethical responsibilities of a psychiatrist to a mafioso? Her job is to make him a better, more effective criminal, and that you do by arranging for his brain to not be upset too much by the fact that, let's say, he would come to and say, you know, every time I kill somebody, I feel this state of revulsion, what I'm doing. I have to kill them anyhow. So what's the psychiatrist supposed to do? One way or another, get him not to feel revulsion when he kills somebody. That gives him a healthy, that'll make him a healthier individual, whatever he's doing. But there's a bit of a difference between being a psychiatrist or being a brain rearranger and being in this case a morphist. Okay, we can take just 5 minutes to say what. Yeah.
Couldn't one deny rationality and just believe in personal objective truths and subjective truths to everyone else? Because they're denying false and true and simple truths.
That's beautiful. I like that. That's a really good thing. Of course, you're using the word truth in a manner which is very different from what most people mean. Subjective truth, is that like, you know, what most of us call falsehood? Is that what most of us call falsehood?
I'm talking about if you're personal. Like, I would think something is objectively true, and you would think something else is objectively true. I'm not denying rationality, I'm just looking at the world from my own viewpoint.
Yeah, so, in my personal opinion, this is the objective truth, but I don't really think that it's one of my personal opinions. In other words, it's not the objective truth. You can use words like page one. What you're saying is, it's not the objective truth, it's just the way I see things. Right? And just to make it clear, take an example which all of us are familiar with, and there's no argument about colors. Okay, we all understand, having taken high school optics, that colors don't actually exist. Right? What actually exists, the way science we basically say today, is wavelengths. Wavelengths don't have colors. Colors is what your optic nerve assigns to a given wavelength. Therefore, color blindness is exactly that. There's a certain percentage of people who are colorblind. They're colorblind, and we're not, because we're the majority. And if it would be 1%, we'd even pay attention to them. But since they're 20%, so you have to be a little bit nicer. But the fact that the wall is... That's a bad example. This whole room is black and white. Red. The fact that the cap on that bottle is red is my personal... Yes, in this case it's true. It's my personal reaction to 333 megahertz, whatever. Right? And all the same sounds. Dogs hear sounds that we don't hear. How many colors are there really? Wow, imagine I'm making up a medrash now. It probably exists someplace. Well, it would exist if Chazal would learn optics. Be a Mashiach, you'll be able to see another 100 colors. You know, the ultraviolet and infrared, we'll be able to see them. And it'll be beautiful because there'll be so many more colors. I mean, if a person can only see 2 colors, his life is really very dull. We can see 7 colors plus. But if you can see 15 colors, life will be even more exciting. Doesn't sound like a classic medrash spoke with mostly the Ora Ganuz. From Yom HaRishon, in sunlight you only have 7 colors, but it should exist. I just hadn't figured it out yet. but it probably does exist. It has to be, discovered in Magnesia. And so you're right. Colors. If a colorblind person says the light is green, and I say no, the light is red. We're not really arguing. What he's saying is, I see green, and I say, I see red. In ethics, that was the case, I think I brought this example. I say, steak is good. And you say, Bensi's fish is good. This actually happened to me today. I walked out of the dining room, and I went and had cookies for lunch. I say, fish is no good. And Bensi says, no, fish is good. We're not really arguing. What are we arguing about? Bensi's saying, fish tastes good, meaning I like fish. And I'm saying, yeah, fish is food for sick people. Cholesterol problem, they make you eat fish. I'll get it with my wife. So the article I quoted by Stevenson says, when you say murder is bad, what you're saying is, I don't like murder. Now, that's true about colors. I say it's red, I mean, I have a red experience. Now, when you say it's green, you mean you have a green experience. The reason why we can still argue about it is because we've agreed that if most people call it red, we're going to call it red. But that's, you know, why should we go by most people? Right? But that's the green rule of nature. To say that everything in the world is my personal opinion about the objective truth is to say that there's no such thing as objective truth, right? Someone comes there, two agents come and say, "Ploni haraget hanefesh." So the judge says to him, "Is that really what happened?" They say, "No, no, no, no. That's my personal opinion about what happened. What really happened, I don't know. I mean, I read Foucault, I read all these postmodernists. I'm not saying that really happened. I'm saying that's what I feel is a good description of the fact. So I don't think we should kill the guy on that basis. You know, he needs to come and say, this is what happened. It's in their opinion, but they're expressing their opinion about the world. They're not expressing their opinion about their opinions. Postmodernism is the theory in literature that says the same thing as we just didn't know about science. You can describe it this way, I can describe it that way. It's all on, everything is in the telling, nothing is in the facts. Yeah.
Is there any way to prove that what I perceive as red is the same thing that everything perceives as red? Like, what I see as red maybe, like, is the same thing that what I see as blue is the same thing that other people see as blue, like this. Is there any way of proving that it's the same?
No, I forgot to mention, the physical reason is, in colors, because you have certain cells in your eye, which are receptive to certain wavelengths, and they are translated to different cells. The cell which is receptive to the red wavelength is connected to a nerve which registers red in your brain. Okay, so if I go into your eye and I replace some of the cells, I take out all the red cells, or I give you another cell that when it's connected to a different nerve, I think this has actually been done, not in sight, but in another areas. If you connect the nerve to a different place in the brain, then there's a study like this. There are certain people, a person has an accident, and he smells colors. Right? When he looks at a red wall, so it smells like this. And a blue wall, it smells different. What the explanation is that the receptor cell has been reconnected to a different part of his brain. Well, the people who hearing colors is actually an investigatable phenomenon. There's like a certain subset, not a large subset, but there are at least 10, 15, 20 people in the world who hear colors. It's hard to imagine. I mean, it's senseless even. It's hard to, I don't know who it's me, but that's what they do. And you paint a blue room, they say, Mozart. And you can paint a blue room, they say, So, because sense phenomena are interpreted, this is one of the basics for this whole movement. Everything is sense phenomena. Sense phenomena is how we interpret things, not what's really there. Colors are a reaction. Sounds are a reaction. Sounds are wavelengths. Air doesn't make sound. Sound is what your brain does when the column affects it. If you have no ear, then there's no sound, etc., etc., etc. There's a lot of basis for thinking like this. Just if you expand it to everything, you're left with nothing. Again, as I pointed out, it's a place you either pay or you don't pay. Okay, let me just describe what we're going to do in the next couple of weeks, which goes back. Today was it's not really a curioso, it's an important point, but it's a closed subject. The version of the cosmological proof that's based on the existence of rationality. We're going to go back to the ethical proof, because the ethical proof I simply assumed, and I threw it out, and I insist that you accept it on that at face value of time, that ethics really exists. There is an objective ethic. When you take the objective ethic, you put it in a religious context, it creates a certain problem. I have to use it to prove religion, to prove that God exists. But on the other hand, when you compare it to normal religion, to traditional religion, where there's a God who is a person who relates to the world by speaking to the world, then the existence of ethics and God creates a problem, the problem of dualism or monism. The question asked originally by Plato in a monotheistic context, and here they put the question in a monotheistic context. So we're going to talk about the question is, does there in fact, in Yiddishkeit, is there in fact an objective ethics? That, and what's its relationship to God? In a non-theistic sense, we weren't religious Jews, and the question would be, is there an objective ethic, and what's the relationship to us? In other words, it's just something which I made up. But in the religious context is there an objective ethic, or is it just something which God made up? As I pointed out before, the question of the basketball, there could be a committee which makes up the rules for basketball. The players are totally, the game, the system that's called the court, bears a supernatural relationship to the rules. But the world at large, the committee doesn't. So the question is there a committee outside of our world whose relationship to the laws of ethics is not the same as ours? That thing outside our world, the best religion is, are there two gods? Is there a God who talks to us in the Torah and another God who is the rules of ethics? Since we know there's only one God, we have to explain how we square that circle. This will take us a while. It's, I think, probably the most crucial question we're going to talk about for some time. A question which people have great difficulty with. Some people have great difficulty with, even though I think the Torah is really has a very simple attitude towards this, but many people find it difficult to accept a simple answer in the Torah. The question that Plato asked, which I'll leave you with the question, is, I'll quote it exactly the way Plato said it, in a polytheistic manner, he said, do the gods like the good because it's good, or is the good good because the gods like it? If we would ask this question, we would change two words. First of all, we wouldn't say gods, we would say God. And two, we wouldn't use the word like, which is a particular Greek way of looking at it. We would say, is the good good because God says it's good? Or does God say it's good because it's good? Does God command us in the Torah not to kill because it's really us to kill? Or is it us to kill because God told us not to kill? I assume anybody in this group knows the answer to the Rambam. But for some reason, many religious people who know they should have known the Rambam don't. And so that's the question we're going to ask. And in context, the question will be, why did Abraham Avinu agree to kill Yitzchak? Since it's us to kill children. And the question which is asked very often about the Akedah, and oftentimes answered in rather strange manners. And recently, I read an article written this year before Rosh Hashanah that claiming that Avraham Avinu didn't kill Yitzhak because it's also to kill Yitzhak. And that's why he got a Shekhiah from God. God said to him, wow, you're a firm guy. You don't kill people even though I told you to. That is against what the Torah says about Avraham and Yitzhak, but someone very serious person wrote this as being the message of the Akedah, and that's what we should think about on Rosh Hashanah. Something which makes it very difficult to say the tefillah. They say, well, the Fadech HaKedah Sh'akar Avraham Yitzhak Avinu Adonai Deach, Kavash Rachama Vlasos Vitzamcha, Ten Kain Tichbosh Rachamecha Eskas Chameleim. So he said, yeah, Chazal didn't think this way, but the tefillah is problematic, but this is what the Torah really teaches. He has a good point. Why would Avraham Avinu kill Yitzhak? Just because God told him to. Aren't you supposed to be ethical at all costs? And anyone here actually have read once Fear and Trembling by Soren Kierkegaard? Oh, good. No one has. It's very difficult to read. It's a very popular book, but no one actually ever reads it to the end. The first 5 pages have nice little stories in the beginning. And after that, you get stuck in this weird Danish-German way of writing that's obviously incomprehensible. So we'll talk a little about Kierkegaard, we'll talk a little bit about the Lichtenstein, we'll talk a little bit about the Torah. And next 2 or 3 weeks. So.